A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark, and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, Alex. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. I've sort of got through St. Patrick's Day in Ireland.
Well, yes, I was going to wish you a belated happy St. Patrick's Day in Ireland. Was it all a great deal of fun?
It was all going on, I tell you.
Okay, in a good
way.
A
week of cranberry juice and salads beckons, I think.
Well, I believe it when I see it.
But, yeah. But okay. In fact, I just got back. I've been, as you know, on my travels, and I just got back to Ireland in time for St. Patrick's Day. But last week, and I'm going to talk about another book-related programme here, if that's all right.
Okay, no, that's all right.
We're a broad church.
We're a broad church. We invite everybody in. It's all good.
Well, I was moonlighting last week and doing a spot of presenting on Radio 4's Open Book, which you can listen to on BBC Sounds, listeners.
All right, yes, let's not plug it too much, shall we?
Not too much, but there is a reason for me telling you this. It was quite, as it happened, nothing to do with me, quite TLS heavy, because I, at one point, hosted a debate about the future of literary criticism. And one of the guests, Lauren Euler, the writer, was a guest. And who else but Toby Lichtig, our very own.
Splendid. I hope that literary criticism has a future. Did you decide that? Or did you say, oh, no?
We talked it up. We said it was tremendously important, and probably everybody who engages it should get some kind of public honour and a pay rise. Yeah.
And a pay rise.
And also, on the same programme, I talked to Jonathan Buckley, who is a TLS contributor, about his extraordinary novel Tell, which I just absolutely loved. So there we are. That is my news. What have you been up to?
Nothing like that, I'm afraid. No, nothing like that. I've just been, you know, working at the coalface, waiting for my honour to arrive through the post and all of that. I always forget to say what else we've got in the paper, because, you know, we talk about two or three things that we've got. But it's full of stuff this week, all very different stuff. There's a big piece by Charles Foster on loneliness, which sounds very sad. It is very sad, actually, but it's very interesting. Aloneness and loneliness and what you can do about it, what you can't do. You know, he says there's all sorts of people feel that, you know, maybe they feel lonely if they don't have a romantic relationship or if they don't have family set up. And he says, but you can get comfort from non-romantic relationships. He says you can get comfort from being bound to, what does he say? So something like a place or an ecosystem or a dog. But it's not a good idea to get bound to an idea, which I thought was a jolly interesting way of putting it.
That won't stop you from being lonely.
No, and it doesn't always go well if that's your primary relationship.
Yes, well, that makes sense. And yeah. I think there are all sorts of interesting pieces. Pieces about Stefan Zweig, for example.
Yep. There's a piece by Francis Wilson about D.H. Lawrence and his wife, Frieda von Richthofen, and their troubled, I think it was troubled, is it safe to say troubled marriage? Eventful, anyway.
Yes, not always plain sailing, we don't
No.
think. I'm not sure what was with D.H. Lawrence, really, though.
No, that's a fair point. There's a piece about Shakespeare in Bloomsbury under influence on Beckett, a piece about the Bible and poetry. The splendid arts pages, of course, of which we will hear one piece later.
And you know, something that I want to read, because so many people have recommended this book to me and this writer to me, Alba de Cespedes, Her Side of the Story, translated by Jill Fulston and reviewed by Caroline Moorhead. So I am immediately, in fact, Toby has recommended it to me very highly, but not he's not the only person.
I think Toby mentioned it on this podcast, so we've come full circle.
We have. Shall we say what is in this podcast, though?
Why not?
Because it's brilliant, I think. I say so myself. Because this week we'll be in the company of two pioneering women as we look at the radical life of Helen Keller and the radical art of Yoko Ono.
But first, we all know a little bit about the story of Helen Keller, the deaf-blind girl who learnt to communicate through her teacher. And the operative words there are a little bit. A new edition of her writing has come out, published by the Library of America, so we get to read her own account of her long, productive and extraordinary life. Andrew Holter has written about this for us this week, and we're delighted that he joins us now. Andrew, thank you so much for talking to us.
No, thank you for having me.
So I learned so much from this. I mean, I was one of the people who only knew a little bit about her life. Can you fill us in a little bit about her early life and the circumstances in which she was born and then sort of came to celebrity, I suppose?
Yes, well, Keller was born in 1880 in a place called Tuscumbia, Alabama, sort of northwestern Alabama, pretty close to the Muscle Shoals recording studio, if you're familiar with
where the
famous R&B records were made. And she was, you have to remember this, is she was born in 1880. That's only 15 years after the end of the Civil War. Her father had been a commander in the Confederate Army. The family had enslaved people who were, of course, manumitted after the end of the Civil War, and whose descendants were still in the area, worked for the house that Keller grew up in as servants. And she was not born with the disabilities that she had. She contracted an illness when she was very young. And there was really not much that the Keller family knew to do about it. I mean, they traveled to the East Coast to see specialists, oculists, as they were known then, to try to find some way of educating their daughter, even in a very rudimentary way. And they eventually went to the Perkins School for the Blind in Boston, which was really the premier American institution for the instruction of people with blindness. And Anne Sullivan, who was Keller's teacher, the miracle worker of the play and film, Anne Sullivan ended up, she was quite young, I think she was 20 years old. She went from the Perkins School to live with the Keller family in Alabama when Keller was still pretty young. I think she was about 7 or 8 years old. And became Keller's tutor, taught her using the kind of latest pedagogical methods coming out of the Perkins School, particularly manual signing, using sign language into the palm of the hand, which Keller learned to do. And her progress, Keller's progress, was watched with a lot of excitement and interest by the directors of the Perkins School. News of Keller's accomplishment that she had learned to communicate made her a celebrity. I mean, this is well before the turn of the century. I mean, she, of course, became one of the most famous Americans of her time.
From that story, the real sense that we get, actually, though, from your piece and presumably from these writings, is the fact that that's just a little, that's the tiny part. That's the kicking off point. Of course, it's an incredibly important part, but that's the kicking off point for her to become who she was, whereas actually that's sort of the bit that everybody gets stuck on, because these are like writings, aren't they? Or a collection of her writings collected by Kim Nielsen, who's written a biography of Keller. And you say that she conveys Keller's, I'm just going to quote you to yourself, I'm really sorry about that, but you put it so well, there's no point me paraphrasing it. So she conveys that Keller's sense of herself as a writer was crucial to fortifying her against the persistent suggestion that her intelligence and conviction were not entirely her own. So people couldn't kind of believe that she had her own intelligence and perception and all of that.
That's right. She had to struggle against that, different versions of that insinuation throughout her life. And she wrote many autobiographical works, not all of which are collected in this book that I've written about for the TLS. This collection includes two books, one called The Story of My Life, which she wrote while she was still an undergraduate in her early 20s at the Radcliffe Institute, which is really the story that you just referenced, Lucy, the story that became the miracle worker, the story of Keller's early life in Alabama, her instruction by Ann Sullivan. And then there's the second book included here, is which we might talk about, is called The World I Live In, which is really different. It is a much more ruminative and probing and philosophical piece of life writing. And then the last third of the book or so are kind of miscellaneous writings, some of them pulled from later autobiographical essays that Keller wrote, some of her polemics that she wrote in the 19-teens especially. But it does give you a sense of how important writing, the work of writing, was to her, that it was an obligation that she felt to prove people wrong, to disprove this constant suggestion that she either didn't have the capability to be as intelligent as she was. And of course, much of that came from popular conceptions of disability at that time. Much of it was just misogyny. Much of it was just this sort of misogyny characteristic of that era. And then also, it clearly was just very important for her to, it was important as an exercise to her to write. I mean, she wrote journals, correspondence, newspaper articles. You know, it was really that kind of intellectual activity was really vital for her. And it gave her, I think it was sort of part of her reason to live, was to write.
I wondered how long Ann Sullivan spent with her, and whether this idea that she was in fact being given her thoughts and ideas and her outlook on the world, was it attributed to Ann Sullivan or to other people? How did that come to be, that understanding?
Yes, I mean, it's interesting. If all you knew about Keller was the old story, the story of the miracle worker and the kind of 19th century Keller, the student, you wouldn't necessarily know that her life with Ann Sullivan lasted a really long time. I mean, they were together until Sullivan's death, which I believe was in 1936. So they were together for like almost 50 years. Wow. You know, they were companions. They had an extraordinarily close relationship that I think is difficult for most of us to even comprehend. I mean, Keller wrote once of Sullivan something to the effect of like, she feels like a part of my body. She wrote different things to that effect.
It's just amazing to me that Ann Sullivan was 20, as you say. She was this incredibly young woman, and that she could make this kind of breakthrough of being the ears and eyes of a very little girl and then develop that relationship. I assume she's probably had all sorts of things written about her too.
It is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, one of the neat things about this collection is that it reproduces The Story of My Life, the first autobiographical book, in the way that it was initially published, which includes Sullivan's account of her education of Keller. So you get these sort of parallel narratives here of Keller explaining what it was like for her to come to this, you know, consciousness through Sullivan that she hadn't had. And then you hear, you know, Sullivan's account writing the Perkins School, sending letters to the Perkins School, giving her updates about this very extremely arduous process of educating this little girl. It is really extraordinary. And Sullivan is just a fascinating figure. I mean, you asked a moment ago, Alex, about Sullivan's responsibility for Keller's, her opinions later in life. Keller went to the Radcliffe Institute, which now has been, it was the women's part of Harvard University that's now been integrated into Harvard. And one of the most important sort of political influences on Keller was a man named John Macy, who was her tutor at Radcliffe. It was John Macy who introduced her to the Socialist Party. They ended up joining the Socialist Party together. But the interesting thing about John Macy is that he also fell in love with Anne Sullivan and married Anne Sullivan.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And the marriage was not a very happy one. They Sullivan and John Macy separated and lived apart for a long time and then divorced. And Macy would kind of hit them up for money. He was not a totally savory character. But it's just this, that relationship that the two of them had is so fascinating and so rich. And it does come through in these writings collected in this book. But for this and for so many other things about Keller's life, I really have to recommend the listeners look at the biographies as well, because there's just so much that's not in here that is just fascinating about Keller's life.
Well, you said that, didn't you? That she, not only was she extremely sort of active in all sorts of ways, but she was prolific. As you said, this is about a fifth of her writing, this collection. There's a whole lot more to discover.
There is. I mean, I get the sense that some of the reason why, and Kim Nielsen, I should say, who is the editor of this, a really brilliant historian named Kim Nielsen. I mean, she knows this material better than anybody. I'm sure there's very good reasons why she might not have included certain essays or writings because of repetition. I will say, you know, one that I really wish was in here that I find so fascinating is an account of Keller and Anne Sullivan, at the time she was known as Anne Macy, this is around 1920, their brief career in vaudeville.
Gosh.
When their finances were extremely low.
Things yes, I didn't expect you to say.
Yes, it's kind of a grim thought. I mean, it's not so, she was really working at the vaudeville circuit, not so far from what would have been called at that time the freak show.
Was it kind of look at this amazing thing as a
sort of curiosity?
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And the audience would ask her questions and Anne Sullivan would be there to would take the stage with her and interpret. What's interesting about it is, I mean, it tells you something about the financial picture for Keller, which was always very difficult and tricky. She had enormous expenses, in part because she had to pay a staff, basically. She had to make sure Anne Sullivan was taken care of, and she had to make sure her other assistants were taken care of. So money was always a concern for her. But, you know, that essay I mentioned about the vaudeville, that's not in this collection. But one of the things that's interesting about it is that her memories of it are pretty rosy, actually. She talks about how much she enjoyed the kind of, you know, sort of circus atmosphere of it, and how she enjoyed hearing stories from the other performers who would talk to her. And I mean, it's so strange, but
it wasn't too grim.
Not for her. I mean, what they were doing was a little more dignified, I think, than,
yes,
you know, it might have been, but still just gives you a sense of these, all these different chapters of her life.
I didn't realize that she was she was a socialist and also a sort of a campaigner, wasn't she? She was active and vocal. And some of that was assumed to be, it was like, oh, well, she couldn't possibly be a socialist from her own thinking. They must have, you know, the malign Reds must have got hold of her and brainwashed her, kind of thing. There was quite a bit of that, wasn't there?
There was. There absolutely was. I mean, she was kind of came to radical politics at a time when the American Socialist Party was quite strong, when the anarchist contingents in America were quite strong. And she was taken seriously by many of the figures in those movements, the political figures in those movements. The labor historian Philip Foner, decades ago, published a collection of her speeches and essays from that period, from about 1909 until about 1920, kind of that vaudeville period. But, you know, that didn't last forever. She was in a difficult position where she, as someone who was such a celebrity and had been thrust into this position of being a representative for all blind people, all people with disabilities, she had to make some decisions about the kinds of public positions that she would take. And I think the older she got, moving into the 1920s, I'm not so sure it's true that she, how much she moderated her personal opinions and her personal politics, but she did make a decision to present herself more as an ambassador on behalf of the blind and to sort of advocate for blind people rather than kind of continue her sort of identity as a firebrand. She had to make a compromise there. And I think it has a lot to do with the nature of her celebrity that she was in that position.
Yeah. So she kind of shifted the weight of what she was sort of advocating for. Tell us about the lovely way she talks about Mark Twain and the way they sort of interacted, the way he talked to her.
Yes, one of the really lovely pieces in this book is a reminiscence of Mark Twain. It's from one of her later collections of autobiographical writings. And it's a portrait of Twain, kind of the older Twain, when he pretty close to his death, I believe. And she loved Twain. And Twain, she writes about Twain as one of the very few people who really treated her as a peer, which I think must have really been special to her because, of course, Twain is also a writer. And, you know, she just says an incredibly beautiful thing about Twain. She writes that, you know, he never pitied me. He never said that it must be so terrible not to see. She says, and this is a quote, "He wove about my dark walls romance and adventure, which made me feel happy and important."
It's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah. It is wonderful. Yeah.
It's moving. Just a final question to you, Andrew. As we sit here now, knowing that rights and movements for the rights of people living with disabilities have altered so incredibly, if not in any way nearly enough, how much do you think Helen Keller played a part in that? I mean, in America especially, obviously.
Yes. I mean, that is a really fascinating historical question. I mentioned toward the end of my piece that if you really want to get a sense of how Keller fits into the bigger picture of what we would now call disability politics in her time, it's hard to get that from this collection. And the reality is that a big part of that story is the influence that Keller did not have on the nascent disability rights movement, on the development of disability politics. Kim Nielsen talks about this really brilliantly, delineates this really lucidly in her biography, that Keller passed up opportunities to organize with other people with disabilities. She didn't press really for things like kind of anti-discrimination statutes, the sorts of issues that the disability rights movement in the United States that would kind of coalesce in the 1970s, the decade after Keller died, the sorts of things that they would press for. Keller didn't really make that connection, didn't really bridge those radical political commitments with disability as a kind of field of political struggle, which is really fascinating. I mean, I think it means that she can't be too easily conscripted into today's contemporary disability justice movement, for example. You know, I think a lot of the premises of disability justice about intersectionality, critique of capitalism, things like that, Keller would have been sympathetic to a lot of those things. But, you know, in important respects, her own politics of disability were kind of conservative.
Even though she was so radical in so many other ways.
Yes, I mean, it's really interesting to think how the development of disability politics in the US and I think around the world might have looked different if Keller had kind of affiliated herself a little bit differently as the 20th century went on. Maybe if she had stayed in closer contact with some of her radical associates of the 1910s. I mean, by the time she was in the 1940s and 50s, she was touring as an ambassador for the American Foundation for the Blind, which was kind of de facto made her a kind of ambassador of the US State Department. And so that's not to say that she abandoned her left-wing convictions by no means, but it's just kind of an interesting thing to wonder, like, what if she had made some of those connections, the connections that future generations of activists made, you know, what that would have looked like. But certainly Keller's example as somebody who insisted on her right to represent herself, to write in her own name, with her own name, to express her opinions, to claim certain political commitments. You know, I think all of that makes her such a vital figure today, and someone really, really worth reading. I'm so pleased that this book exists and will introduce people into her work.
Well, it sounds fascinating, and thank you so much for guiding us through it. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Of course, thank you. Thank you, Lucy and Alex.
Still to come on the show, Peter Maber takes a trip to the Tate to see a magnificent retrospective of Yoko Ono's art.
And to read all the pieces we talk about and much more, remember to subscribe to the TLS. Just head on over to our website at the-tls.co.uk.
And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark. Just as we feel we know the story of Helen Keller, many of us may also think the same about Yoko Ono, all too often seen in the context of her marriage to John Lennon. But Ono's creative life spans seven decades, multiple mediums, and a range of fascinating themes. Now comes a retrospective at Tate Modern, Yoko Ono, Music of the Mind, itself a feat of ingenuity, given the challenges of reproducing her extraordinarily fluid art. Peter Maber has been to see the show and joins us now. Peter, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, Alex.
Well, and it was evidently, reading your fascinating review, a pleasure to go to the show. And I mentioned the staging there because you tell us how well it has been done, but also that it requires a lot of creators. She's a demanding artist to stage, isn't she?
Absolutely. And more than a retrospective, the genius of the show, I think, is that it gets the audience, the viewers, to actually become participants. You have to actively engage in order to truly experience Yoko Ono's art. And the Tate have struck a brilliant balance between curating and commenting on the work and actually allowing people to do things, which is really what her art is about.
Did you find yourself doing things? Did you do lots of participating, or were you sort of watching other people participate and writing it all down?
But both. I did participate. At first, it was a slightly sterile environment. And fortunately, on the day I went, people had brought along some kids and children, and they were completely fearless.
Oh, good. Yeah.
In the works. And that got everyone else participating. So, for example, one of the first works that we encounter is Bagpiece from 1964. All you see is a little arena and four or five black bags hanging up and a couple of curators standing around a little awkwardly. When Yoko Ono performed the piece, or got people to perform the piece, she was there encouraging people, instructing people. And so there's this challenge when she's not in the building, when she's not acting as a facilitator, to actually get involved. And because the children were completely fearless, that got everyone else participating. And that particular piece is extraordinary. I got in a bag and you can see out, but no one can see in. So it completely changes your sense of space. You're able to see what's going on. People can only make of it what they want from the outside. But being inside is an extraordinary experience. And I mean, fortunately, the version was not being encouraged, which Yoko Ono at one stage encouraged, which was for people to get in the bags and then remove all their clothes. So, there's a slight element of risk, I think, in Nona's art. And that's really interesting in terms of what the Tate have and haven't done in reactivating it.
I thought it was fascinating what you said about that when she was there, that she was also probably, I'm sure, a galvanizing presence, but also stabilizing. So that if there was something that was felt a bit risky or felt, you know, that you might expose yourself, I don't mean physically in any way, you know, that she was there and she kind of made it work.
Absolutely. And there haven't been attempts to recreate some of the more, I'd say, dangerous pieces, like a cut piece. One of her most famous pieces is there shown on a film. And this involves members of an audience being brought up onto stage and being asked to cut away pieces of the clothes that Ono is wearing. And she remains silent. The Tate did actually have a description saying that she is sitting on stage motionless, but she's not actually. She is moving around and reacting. And I think those reactions do act as perhaps something of a warning to the audience not to do absolutely anything they want. But this is a really risky piece. And it's, of course, become a really important work of feminist performance art, even though Ono initially spoke about it in rather different ways in terms of the artist giving up control. And she spoke about selfish artists who didn't give enough to their audiences. But she, as with many of her works, they're so open to interpretation. She's returned to that work many times and most recently has referred to it as absolutely a commentary on violence and working in the interests of violence against ageism, racism, sexism of any kind. Mm. So interesting how these works kind of take on a life of their own, including in interpretation.
Well, one of the things that you say her work is about is resistance. And I wondered what she was resisting, how many things she was resisting. How did she go about embodying that in her art?
Yes, I think in some ways her art is an anti-art in multiple senses. She wrote instructions early on, some of which are realizable, some of which are not. And there's one which really grabbed my attention, which was displayed on the wall, called Collecting Piece, where she asks anyone reading it to break a contemporary museum into pieces with the means you have chosen, collect the pieces and put it together with glue. And I found that a fascinating instruction in terms of sort of being iconoclastic, not something we always associate with Ono, who of course is her abiding message is anti-violence, peace above all. But perhaps sometimes there is a sort of dismantling necessary in the interests of resisting set structures. And then that reassembly, mending is a very important metaphor for her that occurs, again, most famously in a piece called Mend Piece, where the audience is invited to glue things back together. But I think resistance is also there in these different ways in which she's been made into different things and has reacted against that and found her own voice always, even in male-dominated environments. So she went on a tour in the 1960s with John Cage and David Tudor, where she was photographed sort of was posing on top of Cage's piano while he performed. And there's the famous story in the recording studio that she was there with the Beatles, and many of the Beatles, apart from John Lennon, felt that she was in the way and were said to have been antagonistic towards her. And that appears to have been resolved over the years, with Paul McCartney saying that he now understood that she was John Lennon's muse. But all of those things seem to be doing something to her, which is taking away from her agency. And quite before she met John Cage, she was doing really pioneering conceptual work. And so I think increasingly, as the years went on, she faced more and more challenges of being made into things that she did not wish to be. And so resistance was both a message and also a way in which she needed to realise herself as an individual artist.
It very often isn't a good thing to be called a muse, is it? And, yes. You know, it really isn't, even though it's in some ways supposed to be.
That's how she met John Lennon, because she was the cool artist in town, wasn't she? She was putting on an exhibition that he came to. It was her work that drew him, as it were, but that gets completely forgotten.
And then what their life was about was a sort of creative collaboration that kind of crossed over into the love relationship between them, I guess.
Absolutely. There's the wonderful story that when they met in 1966 in London Gallery, John Lennon wanted to hammer a nail into her work, which is all about hammering nails, painting to hammer a nail, it's called. And she wanted to charge Lennon 5 shillings to hammer this nail into the canvas. And Lennon replied that he didn't have 5 shillings on him, but could he hammer an imaginary nail? And it was then that Ono said it was this great meeting of minds. But there's this wonderful dimension to the show, too, that it's a kind of homecoming to Ono's London years. And she remained in London until the early 70s. And it was partly because, because of John Lennon. But it was also because the London art scene was so receptive to her art in a way that she found had not been the case when she'd shown in Japan, for example.
I love that observation, her observation, that she found John Cage's music a bit noisy. Which is obviously something that we associate noise with John Cage necessarily. But music is really present, isn't it? Obviously, it's the title of the exhibition, but also in literal form. There are listening stations throughout the exhibition.
Exactly. It's wonderfully laid out with plenty of beanbags and spaces where you can just relax and put headphones on and listen to different tracks. And what really struck me is the phenomenal range of her musical output. She's become so well known today for her electronic dance music that has seen her top the charts in the US. But there's so much going on right from the start in the early 60s. There's recordings of her playing over Ornette Coleman's Free Jazz. And in that particular track I'm thinking of, which is called Eos, supposedly named after the Japanese word for the colour blue, ao, and the word chaos, a kind of hybridity, which she thinks is important to her identity. She has the most extraordinary range of sounds which she produces, a really wide tessitura, no words whatsoever, but unbelievably expressive. She becomes one of the jazz instruments, as so many jazz singers do, but it's very, very distinctive. She has these long, sort of broken, almost sort of keening sounds, so much emotion in that track. And it comes across as being spontaneous, with the free jazz sort of constantly echoing in unpredictable ways what she's doing vocally and vice versa. And then there's also the track she recorded with the Plastic Ono Band with John Lennon often on guitar. There's a fantastic early version of Don't Worry Kyoko. It goes by different names, but this is the first version, which has the subtitle Mummy's Only Looking for Her Hand in the Snow. And the only lyrics are Don't Worry, but the whole song seems to be worrying those words. She's filling her voice with asperity and unpredictable movements and sort of melismas which draw out these words and then sort of fracture halfway through. Quite extraordinary stuff.
I'm afraid I knew, you know, kind of what everybody knew. And I think that I didn't realise she did so much music. And I think that her reputation musically, again, suffered very much from the fact that she was with the Beatles. And because the Beatles were so wonderful and particularly so melodic.
Absolutely.
That when you put her stuff next to it, it's, you know, you can't sing along with it. It's not Hey Jude, is it? But they're very different beasts, I think.
Exactly. And that's what you have in those tracks in the early years of the Plastic Ono Band. You have a sort of counterpointing of very set rhythmical structures of kind of hard rock. And then her voice doing something, unlike the free jazz, doing something very, very different. And that contrast is unique and kind of thrilling and unpredictable and takes those lyrics, which are often very pared down, into all kinds of different dimensions, which get you thinking and get you feeling as well. I mean, a big part of her art and her music especially is about getting emotional responses, again, often in the interest of doing something.
I wonder, Peter, if this song features in the exhibition. It's the song God by John Lennon and the Plastic Ono Band. And it is just this incredible song in which Lennon sings the lyrics, all the things that he doesn't believe in. I don't believe in magic. I don't believe in I Ching. I don't believe in Bible. I don't believe in Kennedy. I don't believe in Buddha. Mm-hmm. I just believe in me, Yoko and me. That's reality. And it's so moving. And it strikes me that one of the things that bound them was loss. They had been both through terrible sort of privations. A lot of that, I think, was to do with Lennon's loss of his mother. Ono had survived the bombing of the firebombing of Tokyo in 1945. They're so intense, their works together, aren't they?
Absolutely. That's an incredibly powerful song. I'm sure it is playing there somewhere. God is a concept, I think it begins. And that really gets you thinking about how much of her work is about ideas and to phrase that in terms of the negatives, what is not believed in, and then what can actually come of that. It's wonderful work, and paradoxes are kind of everywhere in her work, I think.
It's incredible also to think of the longevity of her career. I mean, she's 91 now. Mm. She's created over 7 decades. A lot of that creation happened after the death of John Lennon, when she was really one of the, Jackie Kennedy, the other, the world's most famous widow, in a sense, most publicly observed widow, your grief a thing almost of public possession.
Yes. And her art really has continued to not only be relevant, but she also keeps on producing new extraordinary works. Some of the most exciting interactive works are from recent years. There's an entirely white room with a white boat in it. And this is called Colour Piece Refugee Boat, to draw attention to the refugee crisis. And participants we're all invited to take up blue markers and fill that room with our hopes and beliefs. And again, it's quite risky. The tape won't know what people are going to write on the walls. The idea is that in the end, all of the text, all of the images that we draw there merge into one, and the entire room becomes blue. And when I went right at the start, it was quite sort of bare what was on the walls, and people really were writing political slogans and using this as a form to campaign. And that's both risky and immensely exciting, I think, and good on the tape for putting that on. There's also this sense of gift giving that runs throughout her work. And I wrote about this wonderful, wonderful work right at the end of the exhibition called Helmets, Pieces of Sky, which has Wehrmacht helmets suspended from the ceiling. And they're filled with jigsaw puzzle pieces with an image of the sky on it, her image of sort of endless optimism. And we can take away one of these jigsaw pieces each. And again, it's this wonderful paradox, I think, of sort of dispersing the puzzle even more, dispersing hope, if you like. But I think it carries with it that sense that there can still be hope, even in dispersal, but it's a sort of call to collective action that even as we head off in our different places, we should all be pulling together, we should all be working in the interests of a better world. And quite a lot of this sounds cliche, and Ono gets disparaged for essentialism, for being sort of too obvious, too glib about peace. And I think not at all. I think we need her message more than ever. John Lennon said it about their bed-ins, that if someone thinks that peace and love are just a cliche that must have been left behind in the 1960s, that's a problem. And Ono herself talks about, even though she might have been naive, she says, in the 1960s and 1970s, that the messages she was trying to communicate and still communicates through her enduring art are more important than ever now.
Mm. And as you were saying that, it just struck me how unusual that is to get that message from a fine art exhibition.
Right.
The message of hope and togetherness, and if you do a little bit of something, things can get better. You say that that's a really important thing in her work, that we kind of, we work together, we can make it better. And as you say, it seems very naive, but look at the alternative. Mm-hmm. How's that going? Do you think it's an unusual message?
I think it is. If it's become familiar, it's because Ono has been so influential. She was truly pioneering. Cut Piece is ahead of and inspires Marina Abramovic, and it's 10 years earlier when she is doing those incredibly risky performances. There are some wonderful London-specific works that are documented there as well. I had no idea. She wrapped the lions in Trafalgar Square. Did you know this? In 1966?
No.
Exactly the same time that Christo was wrapping public monuments. But there's certainly people today who resemble her, but I think largely because of her. And just such a shame that she has found her art being dismissed, and of course faced so much overshadowing, as you said at the start, by her association with the Beatles. And I was thinking, you know, would it be possible to have a show that doesn't even mention the Beatles? And probably not, because her collaborations, as we've also said with John Lennon, are so important. And that there's also examples of the conceptual art she produced with him, which is fascinating. There's some glass jars which are labelled with kind of abstract concepts that are supposedly now bottled within. And again, this sort of rethinking of space going on.
Mm. That bit that you say, that when you're talking about the bed-ins and the bed piece, that the artwork that she made out of that, that in the exhibition they display it alongside the tabloid reactions to it. She was just very easy to dismiss in that sense, wasn't she? As serious artists and conceptual artists often have been, but of course she had that, as you say, that further association. But that must have been very interesting to see those things side by side.
That's right. That's where the sort of documentary aspect of the exhibition really excels, I think, in showing how people responded. And it matters because then Ono and Lennon had a lot to say about being serious, but also I think increasingly played on the humorous aspect. And I think sometimes Yoko Ono has been misrepresented as not having a sense of humour. There's actually humour everywhere, and perhaps increasingly so. One of her recurring leitmotifs is a plushing toilet that you hear in a lot of different of the audio work.
Well, that sort of concept of hers seems to me, you know, to be thoroughly embedded in misogyny and racism. She was sort of fighting on both levels, wasn't she?
Right, absolutely. That's the reason why she reinterprets her works, I think, in the light of that, to look back on Cut Piece and say, yeah, in the 2000s, it's a work in the interests of fighting sexism and ageism and racism.
Well, I just can't wait to go and see this show. And you say it runs to September. And, well, you've convinced me thoroughly, Peter.
I'm thrilled. It's a really stunning show and an important show as well.
Well, Peter, I'm glad that you got out of the big black sack and came to talk to us today. We're very, very grateful. Probably you're glad you didn't. Who would take their clothes off in the middle of Tate Modern?
It was the 60s. Maybe in those days it was
the 60s. Yes.
A bit different. You're right.
Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Andrew Holter and Peter Maber.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Charlotte Pardee.
We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, Alex Clark, goodbye.